Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Welcome everyone. Thank you very much for coming to our Bhagavad Gita overview seminar, The Essence of Bhagavad Gita, which is the middle six chapters 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 and 12, understood to be the essence of Bhagavad Gita. So, just as a matter of interest, could you please put your hand up if you have already participated in a Bhagavad Gita overview seminar? One. Two. Is that all? Are you serious? You haven't, Chaitanya does? Bhaktivedanta College. That's what I mean. How many of you have done it in the college? Okay, a number of you. All right. Well, you know, Prabhupada would say that repetition of a good thing is good, or even imitation of a good thing is good. So a lot of these ideas that we're going to be going through, you will have heard, at least many of you will have heard before, particularly if you have actually attended a seminar, in overview seminar on Bhagavad Gita. So in that sense, you know, from the material point of view, it could be this could be considered a little repetitive if you've already attended such a course, but please don't mind if you've heard it before, because it's very good for you. It'll just drive it deeper into your heart and lodge it all deeper there in your heart and enrich your heart even more. And if you haven't attended such a course before, well, that's good. I think you'll find it very interesting, because of course Bhagavad Gita is really our main scripture. Maybe it could be said Srimad Bhagavatam is our main scripture. In one sense that is true, but Bhagavad Gita, you know, I won't ask how many of you have read Srimad Bhagavatam, but I would hope that a number of you have read Bhagavad Gita from beginning to end. Well, that's an interesting point. How many of you have read Bhagavad Gita? Okay, that's not bad. Those of you who haven't, please do. So, we're doing the middle six chapters, as we mentioned, which are said by our acharyas and Srila Prabhupada himself to be the essence of Bhagavad Gita, and really where the real message of Bhagavad Gita is established and brought out very vividly. And we're using what we call the overview system. Normally in our temples we have Srimad Bhagavatam class in the morning, and ideally we're meant to actually have Bhagavad Gita class in the evening, although it's not really as common as Bhagavatam classes there every day. And there we go through one verse at a time, one verse every day. So, you know, Srimad Bhagavatam, there are 18,000 verses. One verse a day means how many years? Any mathematicians here? 365 into 18,000 is sort of like 50 or so, isn't it? Anyway, we have in Durban, we started just after we opened the temple, that was like October, end of October 85, say 20 years ago. We're now in the fourth chapter of the 10th canto. Normally what we do is one verse a day and focus on that for the class time, which is normally half an hour to an hour. But here what we're doing, we're going through these six chapters in six sessions of an hour and a half each. So, you know, it is obviously a little bit of an abbreviated study, but the idea is not so much to go into detail, of course, but the idea is to bring out the themes that are there and show how Krishna is developing the discussion, and yeah, like this, in a little bit broader sense. So, it's a very interesting thing to do, and I hope that you'll find it stimulating. So tonight, we are going to start with Chapter 7, and before we begin, I'll just give a little bit of background. Chapters 1 to 6, what has happened already in Bhagavad Gita. Well, in order to do that, let us look at a statement by Srila Prabhupada in one of the purports of one of the verses here in Bhagavad Gita. This is now actually the purport of chapter 8, verse 28. If you've got a Bhagavad Gita, why don't you turn to chapter 8. Verse 28, and I've just got the excerpt here, you'll have to locate where it is in the purport. But Prabhupada says, chapters 7 through 12 are the essence of Bhagavad Gita. 8:28 in the purport. Can you see where it is? Last paragraph, last verse, yeah. But where in the purport is it? Second to last paragraph, about five lines down into the paragraph. You'll see Srila Prabhupada says, chapters 7 through 12 are the essence of Bhagavad Gita. The first six and the last six chapters are like coverings for the middle six chapters, excuse me, which are especially protected by the Lord. If one is fortunate enough to understand Bhagavad Gita, especially these middle six chapters in the association of devotees, then his life at once becomes glorified beyond all penances, sacrifices, charities, speculations, etc. For one can achieve all the results of these activities simply by Krishna consciousness. So this is a little introduction then to these middle six chapters. Just introducing the idea. Why are we focusing on these? Well, as Prabhupada says here, the first six and the last six chapters are like coverings for the middle six. In fact, the first six chapters are dealing mainly with the subject of different types of yoga. If you have read the book, then hopefully you picked that up, that there's discussions about karma yoga particularly, there's dhyana yoga, then there's something about sankhya yoga, and some Jnana Yoga. These are discussed in the first six chapters. And then the last six chapters from 13 on through 18, they are discussing the subject, well, it's basically different types of knowledge, most of which are somewhat secondary in the last six chapters. Like the 13th chapter, what's the name of that without looking at your Bhagavad Gita? Nature, the Enjoyer, and Consciousness. So it's a discussion about the entanglement of the living entity in this world. And Krishna, in terms of Krishna consciousness. But, you know, it's sort of like the emphasis is more on background information, really, than absolutely essential information. And what's the name of the 14th chapter without looking at your Bhagavad Gita? Or even with looking at it. Well, it's about the three modes of material nature. The three modes of material nature are not very spiritual. They're not very Krishna conscious. But to help us come to grips with our situation within this material world, so we can then address our situation on the material level and rise above it and come to the spiritual, transcendental level, it helps. It helps to have some understanding of the modes, how they're working on me, what types of modes I am particularly influenced by, and therefore what things I should particularly be careful about, watch out for, which may be like the particular obstacles which are generally there if you're influenced by that particular mode. Yeah, like, you know, if you are very fond of eating chili, take a guess which mode you may be in. Maybe passion. Maybe. If you like sleeping a lot, what mode are you in?
Ignorance.
Right. So, yeah. So it may help. It not just may help, it does help to understand the nature of our specific entanglement as individuals. And what are our particular problems as individuals in terms of the modes of material nature, and then we can address them in certain particular ways. Right. And then chapter 16, what's the title of that? Divine and Demoniac Natures. And well, the first few verses, Krishna talks about the divine nature or the characteristics of a devotee, really. But the great majority of the 16th chapter is talking about the demon. Yeah. Which is, you know, not exactly directly part of being a devotee. But it is interesting to understand. So it's sort of like background information. Of course, in the 18th chapter, Krishna summarizes everything in the whole Bhagavad Gita. So that's special. That's very, very important. But otherwise, these middle six chapters are taken to be the essence because they are describing what is really the subject matter of Bhagavad Gita. Which is what? Take a guess, go on. Speak up? Okay. I thought someone was going to say, Krishna. And then I was going to say, no. Just like one time, Prabhupada was, just after they opened the Krishna Balaram temple, Prabhupada was every day going for a walk around the temple and pointing out things that were wrong. you know, this light's not working, this is broken, something like that, different things like that. So he pointed out one thing and said, what are we going to do about this? And the temple president said, we will become more Krishna conscious. Prabhupada replied, an impractical suggestion. You know, you might think it is the essence of all practicality, but Prabhupada was being more particular. Right, so, you know, you may have heard, well, Prabhupada mentions here, the first six and last six chapters, they're like protective coverings on either side of the middle six, which is then in the middle. And our acharyas have given different analogies to illustrate, you know, the importance of this arrangement. One is, one of our acharyas gives the example of the analogy of a sandwich. In a sandwich, you have the bread at the bottom and the bread at the top, and in the middle you have the filling. But unless you're some sort of health fanatic who's very concerned about is it whole wheat or, you know, you won't be very worried about the bread, but you'll be interested in what's in the middle, isn't it? This is generally what sandwiches are about. What's in the middle? Not just the bread. Of course, if the bread is not there, then what's in the middle will just fall out. So the bread is useful, actually. Yeah, so that's one analogy which is given to illustrate the importance, the significance of the middle six chapters in relation to the others. Then there's also the analogy of a king traveling with his entourage. He won't go right out in the front. There'll be an advance party making the arrangements and announcing and getting everyone and everything ready. And he won't just go in the back, because people might sneak up from him from behind and do something. So he goes in the middle. There are people in front and people behind. Just like so, like that. The middle six chapters are there, being protected, introduced and protected by, and so on. The first and last six chapters. Then another analogy is that Bhagavad Gita is like a treasure chest. Treasure chest has a top, and you know, the bottom is there and the treasure is in the middle, isn't it? And then you need a key. If you've got the key, you can unlock the chest, and then inside, in the middle, you can access the treasure. So like that. If we get the key, particularly from the first six chapters, which are pointing out, first of all, discussing the subject of yoga in general, but then they do, just at the end of the sixth chapter, Krishna then brings out that bhakti yoga or devotional service. This is really the process. This is what we should be aiming for and trying to develop. So this is the key. We get this understanding, yes, I must. As Prabhupada says here, if one is fortunate enough to understand Bhagavad Gita, especially these middle six chapters, in the association of devotees, then his life becomes completely glorified. So if in the association of devotees we get this idea that I have to become a devotee and develop my devotional service, is like the key. And then these middle six chapters, they become very, very wonderful. One gets access and one appreciates them, and then they enrich your life. So these are some ideas about the importance of the middle six chapters. then, okay, so I just mentioned that at the end of the sixth chapter, Krishna introduces the subject of devotional service. Devotional service is the subject of the entire Bhagavad Gita. Well, basically the idea is Krishna is trying to convince Arjuna, you should become a devotee. You should take up devotional service. This is Bhagavad Gita. And in the middle six chapters, the glories of devotional service and how and why to execute it, these types of things are discussed. And who can practice successfully, who can't, what to look out for, what to cultivate, what to avoid. All these things are addressed in the middle six chapters. And this is what the Bhagavad Gita is all about. So Bhagavad Gita, in one sense, comes to a climax in the middle. That's unusual, isn't it? You know, normally when you go to the movies, Hare Krishna, or something like that, then the climax, when is the climax? It's at the end, isn't it? What sort of movie would it be if it came to the climax in the middle and then just sort of, you know, petered out? So generally, it's like that, isn't it? It sort of builds up and comes to the highest point at the end. But Bhagavad Gita is not quite like that. Although in another sense it is, in that, like I said in the 18th chapter, Krishna summarizes everything and really brings out again, right at the end, the subject of devotional service very vividly. So it is like that, you know, sort of a climax is there. But the middle six chapters, all six chapters, are focusing on the subject of devotional service in depth and from different perspectives. So in that sense, the middle six chapters, they really are, you know, like the high point of Bhagavad Gita. So, now, at the end of the sixth chapter then, let's just have a quick look. If you've got a Bhagavad Gita, we'll look at verses 45, 46, and 47. Now we mentioned how the first six chapters are particularly dealing with yoga, different types of yoga, the spiritual elevation, karma yoga, dhyana yoga, and various others. So 45 and 45, Krishna says, when the yogi engages himself with sincere endeavor in making further progress, being washed of all contaminations, then ultimately achieving perfection after many, many births of practice, he attains the supreme goal. So this is the idea. You practice yoga, you achieve the supreme goal. Then 46. This is very important. Very important point. A yogi is better than the ascetic. Greater than the empiricist, and greater than the fruit of worker. Therefore, O Arjuna, in all circumstances, be a yogi. This is a very important point. Yogis are better than the ascetics, the renunciates, the empiricists, you know, like the intellectual types, speculators, and people like that, and greater than the fruit of worker. Better than those three categories. What other types of people are there? Well, before anyone makes any suggestions of other types, let us just say that actually there aren't any other types of people. If there appear to be other types of people, other categories, they are just subsets of these three types. This is the idea. In other words, Krishna has just referred to the entirety of humanity under these three headings. Either they're renunciates, or they may be intellectuals, you know, researchers, speculators, materially thoughtful people, or even spiritually thoughtful people trying to figure things out. Or fruit of workers. People are just trying, in one way or another, to get material things for their material enjoyment. Now, of course, Krishna was speaking 5,000 years ago. In those days, there may have been a lot of ascetics. They may have been like a real section of society. But nowadays, I think they're in short supply, isn't it? Where are the renunciates? Hey, I don't know. Well, I don't think there are many at all. Really. Intellectuals and speculators, well, there's some of them. The scientists and philosophers and people like that. Not a huge number, but there's some of them. But fruit of workers, oh, people who, by this means or that, either religious or, you know, praying to God, give us material things, or just by working hard to get material things, or by stealing to get material things, one way or another, the vast majority of the population would fall under this heading, isn't it? Of being fruit of workers in one way or another. Yeah. So, in other words, Krishna, in, you know, one sentence, has written off the entire human race. Goodbye. Out the window. Yeah. So therefore, we should always be yogis. In the broad sense, he's meaning in the broad sense. There's so many different types of yoga, as we said. So he's meaning in the broad sense, some type of yogi. A person who's practicing some type of process for spiritual elevation, whatever type of yoga it might be. So best to be a yogi, because the yogis make the most advancement. They become elevated to the spiritual platform. The others don't really, or if they do, some of them, they don't so much at all. But the yogis, they become spiritually elevated. So this is the point in verse 46. Out of the whole of human society, the yogis are the best. They make the most advancement. So we should all try and be yogis. But does this mean that we, just any type of yoga, just choose your yoga, whatever appeals to you, and it's okay because, you know, it doesn't make a difference? No. No. In the last verse here, text 47, the last verse of chapter 6, and it is the last verse of the section dealing with different types of yogis. So Krishna clarifies, there's so many different types of yoga, and they have different goals, different practices, and they're trying to achieve different types of spiritual objectives. Some are trying to achieve an impersonal goal. Some are trying to achieve the super soul. Some are trying to achieve mystical powers. So then Krishna says in verse 47, and of all yogis, the one with great faith who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service to me, he is the most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. Yes, so, this is very important. Krishna is making it clear. The yogis are the best, but not all yogis are equal. Or as they say, what is it? All yogis are equal, but some are more equal than others. Or something like that. Yeah, so just because you're a yogi doesn't mean that you are really on the highest level. But amongst the yogis, there are different gradations. There's a hierarchy. So Krishna, who is Yogeshwar, the master of yoga, the lord of all yogis, Krishna is giving his judgment here. That out of all the different types of yogis, the bhakti yogis, those who with great faith are fixing their minds on him and rendering service to him in devotion, they are the best of all the yogis. So therefore, we should all try to be bhakti yogis. We should all be devotees. Right, so this then brings us to the seventh chapter. Well, it brings us to the middle six chapters. In the middle six chapters, Krishna is explaining this one verse. What do you think of that? It is, you could say, it can be argued that chapters 7 through 12 are just an explanation and elaboration on chapter 6, verse 47. Yeah. You should be a devotee. This is the best thing. The devotees are the best. They achieve the highest goal. And then he explains what that's all about. Yeah. Just like, although you may not have thought about it in these terms, the entire Srimad Bhagavatam is an explanation of the first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. Did you ever think of that? Yeah. Right. So, therefore, these middle six chapters are really very, very important. How to achieve the highest goal possible. Going back home, back to Godhead, and the process, actually the only process, is devotional service. Okay, so let us now go into chapter 7. You've got your overview books there. Although it's all quite abbreviated, but it's giving the essence of it. So that's very nice. You'll see in the purport of verse 1, Prabhupada says, let me just try and find it. Oh yeah. Right at the beginning of the purport, what does Prabhupada say? In this seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita, the nature of Krishna consciousness is fully described. How's that? Prabhupada's really making this point very clearly. So in order to get into the seventh chapter, get into the subject of bhakti yoga, devotional service, which is the essence of Bhagavad Gita, let us now look at the first verse of the seventh chapter. Let's just focus on that for a minute or two. Because, you know, like that, like we said, chapters 7 through 12, in a sense, are like a purport to the last verse of the sixth chapter. You could say that. But you can also say that chapter 7, verse 1, is that answer, that elaboration, in a nutshell. Chapter 7, verse 1, has the message of these middle six chapters there in a very succinct, very brief form, but it's there. And, you know, very, very, very interesting point. This is really quite an extraordinary point, which I'm sure some of you are aware of. Prabhupada, every day Prabhupada would give a lecture, or two, yeah, or sometimes three, but every day generally he'd give one or two. And he chose different places to lecture from. It's interesting if you look at, you know, the lists of all the lectures that are available. You'll see he lectured on some things more than others, some things he didn't lecture on. I mean, some verses or some chapters or some cantos even. Yeah. Now, very interesting point. Bhagavad Gita chapter 7 verse 1 is the verse of all verses, either in Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam or anywhere. This is the verse Srila Prabhupada lectured on the most. He lectured on this verse. There are about 25 recorded lectures on this one verse. That's really significant. You know, there's a whole set of books which are transcriptions of Prabhupada's lectures on Bhagavad Gita. I think there's 7 volumes. All his recorded lectures on Bhagavad Gita typed out. Of those 7 volumes, 1 volume is almost entirely made up of transcriptions of lectures on this one verse. That means something, doesn't it? It really means something. So in other words, this verse is really very, very important. Because like I said, it has the essence of the subject of Bhagavad Gita in a nutshell, expressed nicely. So let's have a look at that. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, Maya Sakta Mana Parta, Yogam Yunjan Madashraya, Asamshayam Samagram Mam, Yata Gyasyasi Tach Trinum. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Now hear, O son of Prita, how by practicing yoga in full consciousness of me, with mind attached to me, you can know me in full, free from doubt." So, Krishna is saying that he's going to explain. Well, he's going to explain how, but this is what it's made up of. He's going to explain how, but it is made up of these elements. Fixing the mind on Krishna. You've got to be Krishna conscious. You've got to be conscious of Krishna. You know, if you are Krishna unconscious, how are you going to be a devotee or practice bhakti yoga? You have to be conscious of Krishna first. Before you do this, before you do that, you know, before you do anything in devotional service, you have to be thinking about Krishna. Otherwise, it's not Krishna consciousness. It's just something else. Yeah, so that is the first element. You have to think of Krishna. Control your mind and think of Krishna. And you have to practice this yoga. Well, that may seem to be quite vague, but practicing the yoga means you have to render devotional service. Krishna has already mentioned that. You have to render service. You have to do things for Krishna. In other words, it is also, like we said, if you just do the things and you don't think of Krishna, you know, you're thinking about your work, your friends, your family, and so on, while you're doing the things, you're not thinking of Krishna. So that's no good. But what about if you just sit there and think of Krishna, and then they come and ask you, "Prabhu, could you please wash the pots? I am thinking of Krishna." That also won't work. It's incomplete. It's, you know, either imbalanced that way or that way. Yeah. "Will you wash the pots?" "No, I am thinking of Krishna." "Will you sweep the floor?" "No, I am thinking of Krishna." Will you help take out the rubbish?" "Oh no, I'm too busy thinking of Krishna." "Will you take prasadam?" "Well, if you insist." You're insisting, aren't you? "No. Oh, I insist." Okay. So it's not just a matter of thinking of Krishna and being conscious of him, but that consciousness is meant to be an inspiration to do things for him. Krishna is so wonderful that I'm thinking about him all the time. But he's so wonderful that I'm thinking about him, I'm becoming so inspired, he's so wonderful, I want to do something for him. So therefore, devotees, Krishna conscious people are not what we call armchair philosophers. Yeah. You know, there was one famous member of the British nobility whose name I forget, but he was sort of like the Earl of something or other. And he had some big mansion and all the rest of it. And I saw an interview of him and he was saying, actually I'm a communist. While sitting in his big mansion. So this is literally an armchair philosopher. So Krishna consciousness is not for armchair philosophers. Neither is it for people who just mindlessly run around in circles. You know, there has to be a combination of the two. The consciousness, and if the consciousness is there nicely, then naturally devotional service will come. One will naturally be inspired. Okay, so now here is Sunapita. How by practicing yoga and full consciousness of me with mind attached to me, you can know me in full. So we have to come to understand Krishna. In full. What do you think that means? Does that mean you have to understand everything about Krishna? From A to Z, you know? The beginning of Krishna to the end of Krishna? Well, no. To know Krishna in full means until you are full. Yeah. As much as you can. Our minds, right? Our heads are about this by that. How much Krishna are you going to squeeze in there? You won't get the whole lot. But we should come to know Krishna as much as we're able in terms of our capacity. Prabhupada said, actually, you may have different sizes of glass. And so you got one small one, one medium, one big. But the big one may look at the small one and say, oh, look at you. You're so small. I've got so much more than you. But even the little one, when it's full, it's full. It's full. Even if you try and put more in, what difference is it going to make? So it becomes complete. So there are different levels of pure devotees. Even, you know, like servants and friends and parents and conjugal lovers. But even those who are on the, you know, quote unquote, lower levels, they're not feeling, oh, we're not doing so well. Look at the, you know, look at Radharani, wow. She's better off than us. And in this way becoming, you know, envious or whatever. They're fully satisfied. So Krishna means like that. You should know me in full in terms of your capacity. Yeah. Right. So this is what Bhakti Yoga is all about. This is what it means to be Krishna conscious. And the idea now is that Krishna wants to explain to Arjuna how this is important. We need to know how. Otherwise we may just make up our own way and that probably won't help. Right, so here we are then in the overview book and we have our first section here. Verses 1 to 3, knowing Krishna in full by hearing about him. So this is the point then. How to do this? Oh, there's another element which I didn't mention, which I didn't focus on. Krishna says, touch Trinun. Hear from me. So this is another part of it. You have to hear about this. You have to hear about this from Krishna, not from your mind. But you have to hear from Krishna or Krishna's representative. Then you'll learn how. Not Krishna consciousness is not a DIY process, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Of course you have to make your own effort, but you don't invent your own way. No, we are following the instructions of the actual authorities, the great authorities. So we have to become conscious of Krishna. Our minds have to become attached to him. And Krishna now addresses this. You can look at verse 2 if you've got your Bhagavad Gita there. You got a Bhagavad Gita? Did we bring Bhagavad Gitas for those who don't have? Anyway. If you didn't bring a Bhagavad Gita. No, I mean, we should have brought a box. We could have sold some Bhagavad Gita. If ever there was an opportunity. Okay, we got a box. See Chaitanya Das. So now verse 2 is very important. Very important. I shall now declare unto you in full this knowledge, both phenomenal and numinous. That means both material and spiritual. This being known, nothing further shall remain for you to know. So, in other words, Krishna is saying, I am now going to explain it all to you. And actually, from this point on, from verse 2, well actually, he really gets into it from verse 4. Anyway, before I get to there, let's look at verse 3. So Krishna said, I'm going to explain how, in verse 1. Here in verse 2, he takes it a step further by saying, I'm going to explain it all, everything you need to know. Then in verse 3, it's like a qualifying statement that out of many thousands among men, one man endeavor for perfection, and of those who have achieved perfection, hardly one knows me in truth. In other words, it's rare. This is a special thing. This is a special thing. To actually become Krishna conscious is a special thing. You know, many people may set out on the path, not so many may make it to the end. Or, you know, some may have some setbacks and come later like that. That's the point here in verse 3. Now then, verses 4 to 12. This is a very important group of verses because, you know, the idea is, as stated in verses 1 and 2, that we need to understand Krishna. We need to get our minds attached to Krishna. That's the first thing. Get your mind attached to Krishna. That's step number 1. So here now is like, from verse 4 to verse 12 is sort of like a crash course. Some of the really important and main ways that you can get your mind attached to Krishna. Some of the very important and valuable concepts which are there, which will help you to get your mind attached to Krishna in different ways. So let's go through then, from verse 4 to 12. So, verses 4 and 5, let's see, yeah. We've grouped 4 and 5 together as a subgroup. In verse 4, if you've got your Bhagavad Gita there, Krishna talks about the material elements, earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and these are all his separated energies. Then verse 5, Krishna says, Aparayam itas twanyam prakritim vidhi me param. There is another energy which is superior, the spiritual energy. So, you know, this is really in a nutshell, this includes everything in the material world. The idea is that we are to help us attach our minds to Krishna. So here Krishna has explained that everything is connected with him. So when you see anything, everything material is made of earth, water, fire, air, and ether, and mind, intelligence, false ego. And at least where there's life, it's the spirit soul. So in this way, Krishna has explained in a nutshell how we can connect everything with him. Everything. Everything material and all the spiritual living entities. So wherever you see some earth, you should think, aha, this is Krishna's earth. Right? That's really how we should see things. Then, verses 6 and 7. Well, verse 6, Krishna makes the point, all created beings have their source in these two natures. And these two natures are his natures. So wherever we see living beings, wherever we see anything going on, we should be able to connect this with Krishna. And in this way, remember Krishna. Have our mind attached to Krishna, which is the essence of being Krishna conscious. Then to connect it even more to himself, verse 7 is there. This is a classic verse. There is no truth superior to me. Everything rests upon me as pearls are strung on a thread. Such an important verse. Everything is resting on Krishna. You are resting on Krishna. Everyone is resting on Krishna. Without Krishna to support anything and everything, everything would collapse. Just as, you know, you have your neck beads on, I hope. Have you got your neck beads on? Okay. But your neck beads obviously are not just sort of hanging there of their own accord. There is a thread, isn't it? But the problem is, you don't see the thread. So if you are, you know, in this case you'd have to be fairly foolish, you might think these beads are just sitting here. It's the beads. But it is not just the beads. If the thread was not there, the beads would be, it would be a mess. So this is the principle. We should try and see things in these terms. How everything is being sustained and supported by Krishna, even though we can't see him. Yeah? Right. So then, some examples. Let's see. Actually, verse 8 to verse 11 is some examples given by Krishna. Let's have a look at these. I am the taste of water, the light of the sun and moon, the syllable om in the Vedic mantras. I am the sound and ether and ability in man. So, if whenever you drink water, well, whenever you drink water, water has a special taste, isn't it? They'll pray. So whenever you drink it, it's so special. Water is sustaining everything. If you took the water away from life, that would be it. You know, within a week, I think, very quickly, everything would be dead. So water is really special. And in terms of sustaining reality, So whenever you drink some water, you should remember, this is so special. Why is it so special? Because Krishna is behind it. What to speak of if you drink some liquid fruit or... You know, there's the story I'm sure many of you have heard, how Prabhupada was lecturing in 26 Second Avenue and two drunks came in with bottles of wine and rolls of toilet paper in the other hand. Quite a sort of sight, I guess. And they were, Prabhupada was giving a class in the temple, and they just walked in. And they were inviting everyone, here, have a drink. And creating a disturbance. Not a big disturbance, but certainly a disturbance. So then, they had rolls of toilet paper in the other hand. They walked in 26 Second Avenue, the toilet is at the back of the temple room. Even now, we're still using the same place. The toilet, you have to walk right through. They walked right through, past Prabhupada, and put the rolls of toilet paper in the toilet, and walked out while waving to everyone. You know what I mean. And the devotees were thinking, wow, this is terrible. You know, what an insult, what an offense. Prabhupada said, just see, even though they are not all right, which is, you know, a very nice way of putting it, even though they are not all right, but still they have rendered some service. Then Prabhupada said that if, even these people, if whenever they drink their wine, they think, this is the taste of Krishna, this taste is Krishna, then eventually they'll become Krishna conscious. And of course, the point we make every time we mention this is to the devotees, you don't need to do that. Just when you drink water, you're already beyond that stage. Okay. Yeah, so the taste of water and the light of the sun. Water and the sun, without these two things, even if you have water but no sun, it'll be very, very difficult. So these are like the essential building blocks of life that Krishna's mentioning here. The light of the sun and the moon, the syllable Om, the sound in ether and ability in man. These are some of the most essential things in life, aren't they? Where would humanity be without its ability, without the intelligence? Just be like animals. And without the mantras of the Vedic literatures, where would we be in our spiritual practices? Without the light of the sun, where would we be? Without water? Now the point is, see, the point here is, not exactly that, you know, say your ability, you all have some ability. You can read, you can write, and you can understand what we're saying. The dogs, the cats, they can't read or write, they can't understand really what we're saying. Not very much, at least. They don't have that ability. We have more ability. Krishna says, I am that ability. The special ability that man has. Krishna says, that is me. So what does that mean? Does that mean that we are all, you know, like repositories of Krishna or manifestations of Krishna? Or the taste in water, does that mean that it is actually Krishna himself in the water? And because if it was, we should worship the water, shouldn't we? And that, like, Krishna is the sun. Does it mean that Krishna is exactly the sunlight, that this is Krishna the person. This is not the point. The point is that these are all different energies of Krishna. Krishna's special potencies being invested in different things, so they then display special qualities and characteristics. So it's not like Krishna himself is there, but his potencies are there. So this whole idea that we have to fix our mind on Krishna, that this is the essence of the process, like the basic feature in the process. The idea is that we should develop that type of insight, that type of vision, to appreciate that when we see special things in the material world, those special things which are just keeping everything going and making everything work, we should understand Krishna is behind this. This is his potency. In this way, whatever we see, we can connect it with Krishna. Like Krishna says, you know, just to further illustrate the point that we shouldn't think that it is necessarily Krishna himself who is, you know, like our ability, our intelligence. But it's Krishna's potency which gives that special quality. Later on, we'll see, in fact, Krishna, in different places in these chapters, he explains things in similar terms. I am this, I am that, I am so many things. He gives many, many examples of things within this world, and he says, I am this and I am that. One thing he says is, I am the gambling of cheats. So, you know, if you somehow find some gamblers and there's one big expert, he's ripping everyone off and just somehow he's winning every time. He's a real expert gambler. You should not think that he is Krishna. Okay? But his, even though it's like a devious thing, and we don't appreciate it, but it is a very special thing. That special ability to be able to cheat successfully. In its own way, it's a very special thing. So that ability, that potency is coming from Krishna. And what else does Krishna say? Krishna says, amongst fishes I am the shark. So does this mean if we're at the beach we see a shark going by, we should immediately think, ah, my Lord, and go swimming out to embrace him? So you don't need to do that, okay? But the shark is very special. The shark has no predators, only human beings. Yeah. So they're very special creatures, very powerful creatures, and very outstanding amongst the fish. So Krishna says, amongst the fish, I am the shark. They display these special abilities and qualities and powers which are coming from Krishna. So in this way we can connect everything with Krishna when we're looking around in this world. Whatever we see happening, we learn how to connect it with Krishna. Or not just connect it with, but understand and see how it is connected with Krishna. And in this way we become Krishna conscious. Even here within the material world, wherever you look, you'll see there's Krishna, Krishna's energy, Krishna's potency. This could only happen because of Krishna. Without Krishna's mercy, this couldn't happen, this person couldn't do like that. This is the idea. So In these verses then, 8, 9, 10, and 11, Krishna's giving different examples like that. I'm the original fragrance of the earth. This is verse 9. This is very important. Like, fragrance means flowers, basically. So, you know, you smell a flower, and it has some fragrance. Anyway. No, they have a fragrance. Kali Yuga, you know, it's not easy. But traditionally flowers have fragrance, like a nice jasmine, gardenia, something like this. Very fragrant. Where's the fragrance coming from? Well, you know, if you take the seed, where does the flower come from? From the plant, which comes from the seed. So if you smell the seed, what does the seed smell like? Not much. Not nice like the, like a nice gardenia or jasmine. And, or the plant, you know, the branches or whatever. If you smell them, what do they smell like? So if the fragrance is not coming from the seed or from the branches, where is the fragrance coming from? It's not coming from nowhere. It is coming from the earth. Perhaps we never thought of this, but earth embodies all fragrance. In fact, you know, in the list of all the elements and the sensory activities connected with them, like water has taste, ether you cannot see, but you can hear. It only, the sensory capacity of hearing is the only one present in ether. But in earth, they're all present, including fragrance. That if you pick up a lump of earth, well, it smells, but it's like a sort of conglomeration of smells. But the flowers are made in such a way that certain, out of that conglomeration, certain fragrances are attracted, are extracted by particular species of flowers. Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. Just like a perfume. You know these expensive perfumes that you buy? Hare Krishna. Well, did you know they're only 5% or so fragrance? And usually 95% alcohol, did you know that? It's normally like that. And the reason is, of course they want to make more money, I suppose. But one reason is if they just gave you the actual fragrance, then it's so concentrated you won't really smell anything. Or you just smell, you know, too much. Yeah. So like that, earth has all fragrances concentrated in it. And the flowers, different species extract different particular fragrances. But if you smell earth, it just smells like, you know, something, nothing very nice. Right, so different examples then are given here. I'm the heat and fire, the life of all that lives. I'm the penances of the ascetics. Hey, it's 9 o'clock. And then let's finish with verse 12. So these other verses then, 10 and 11, Krishna's giving different examples like that. And then in 12 he summarizes, know that all states of being, be they of goodness, passion or ignorance, are manifested by my energy. Yeah. I am in one sense everything, but I am independent. I'm not under the modes of material nature, for they, on the contrary, are within me. So this is Krishna's point. The idea is he wants to help us so we can fix our minds on him in any situation. Surrounded by any circumstances, we'll be able to see, oh yes, Krishna is here. This is Krishna's energy. In any situation, But then at the same time, we have to understand it's his energy. It's not him. He's in the kingdom of God. But this is his energy. Cannot be separated from him. In this way, we can remember him. Okay, so that's a little start now to our seminar. Anyone have any questions or comments?